Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in to the program tonight. How many post-rapture parties did you attend? The attention that that freakish man got was just pretty strange. Pretty strange indeed. Somebody sent me a definition, I guess. The rapture is not a Christian teaching. It is Buddhist. Rapture is called piti, P-I-T-I, piti, in Buddhism, and it means rising up to a higher consciousness that will make people more civil. It has absolutely nothing to do with flying up into the sky. Christian fundamentalists, according to my writer here, took this concept from Buddhists and failed to understand it as a matter of consciousness. Meeting Jesus in the air means in your head. Rising to meet Jesus in the air means to raise your consciousness in meditation to the third stage, earth, water, air, fire, new mind. The third stage, which is called air, and where you separate from human thought. That's what the rapture is, and that's what rising to meet Jesus in the air is all about. It's all in your head. Okay, well, I'm certainly glad that was explained. But my emailer here did not stop there. Bill wants to give us some more information here about, what's this about? Oh, they base the end of the world, the time of the end of the world, by the number of bones in your hand. Bill writes, the second reason the rapture did not work out is because the Christians involved used the numbers and dates given in the Bible, and based on those numbers came to the May 21st, 2011 date. Where did seconds, minutes, hours, days, months, and years come from? They came from ancient Egypt and Babylonians and Sumerians. The numbers came from the construction of the human hand. The thumb was the pointer, and the other, or the four fingers were counted as three each because of the three phalanxes. You know, your finger divided into three pieces. You want me to keep going with this? All right. If they had just counted the fingers, we would have had 10 months and we would all be much older by now. But they counted four fingers times three phalanxes. That equals 12. Okay. That made them decide there was 12 months. All right. They had two hands, so 2 times 12 equals 24, so there were 24 hours in a day. Okay. The Sumerians were obsessed with the number 60, and so we wound up with 60 seconds, 60 minutes. How did they get 60? Well, they figured each hand phalanxes, there were 12, and there were 5 fingers, so 5 times 12 equals 60. You with me here? No? Wait, there's just a little more. Of course, the Egyptians and the Babylonians added their changes, and on it went. And so the reason there are 60 minutes in an hour is due to the mathematics of the Sumerians, Babylonians, and Egyptians, and the structure of the human hand. This is from a website called Science Ray. One more thing. The Christian fundamentalists figured the end of the world for the month of May. The name of the month of May was derived from the Greek goddess of love, Aphrodite. May. Mayas. Maya. I doubt that the preacher knows that. Bill. Bill has a website, hiddenmeanings.com. No, I didn't go there, so be careful. Okay, well, I'm glad we have that straight. I mean, that was just making me crazy. So now you know. Number 60, the number 12, phalanxes, and this and that and the other thing. Horror in Joplin, Missouri over the weekend. When was it? Sunday? Just astonishing. Our sponsor this hour, Alain Boulard, Alain Brulard. He has a message. Hi, Mike and Kathy. On my 50th birthday, I'm glad to give back and sponsor an hour of the Molloy Show. Truth Seekers, let's support each other. Please sponsor an hour when you get a chance. Alain Brulard. I'm sorry, Alain. I am not very good with the French. Alain Brulard. Brulard. Thank you, Alain. Do-do-do. More fundamentalist Christian craziness. A minister offering the opening prayer at the Minnesota House of Representatives Friday, day before the rapture, appeared to question Obama's belief in Jesus in remarks before lawmakers. In remarks before the lawmakers could begin debating a same-sex marriage ban. Jesus, God. Yeah, I mean, of all the things going on in the world, to stop people from writing a contract involving marriage is, not only is it insane, but it's, I don't know, it shows butt-level consciousness. Bradley Dean, an Annandale, Minnesota-based Christian minister, did not mention Obama by name, but noted that the opening prayer is supposed to be non-denominational. He closed the prayer by saying that it was not about any one denomination, quote, but rather the head of the denomination, and his name is Jesus, and every president up until 2008 has acknowledged, end quote. Well, knock me down and call me flattened. Obama was elected in 2008, so I guess that means, well, of course it does. The head of the denomination, and his name is Jesus, as every president up until 2008 has acknowledged. What does Obama have to do? Does he have to rip off his shirt and show you a sword wound in his side? Does he have to turn his hands outward so you can see the, what's that called, the stigmata in his hands? Does he have to, you know, all those scars on his head? Is that from wearing a crown of thorns? Why don't these people just shut the hell up about this stuff? What is wrong with you people? People, stopping gay folk from forming a contract, insisting Obama doesn't recognize Jesus. Is that all you have to do, you silly geese? The appearance of this freak sparked outrage from Democrats and an apology from the Republican Speaker of the House. Boom, 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 boom. The Minnesota House is expected to soon debate a Republican proposal, oh, there's a surprise, to put a constitutional amendment on the state ballot in 2012 that would ban gay marriage. And the Reverend Bradley Dean's website offers a link exhorting viewers to, quote, watch this video debunking the homosexual agenda and their lies. God damn them. But Dean said his prayer had nothing to do with gays, but encouraged honoring veterans and upholding the Constitution, and he had not known he would be speaking the same day as a possible gay marriage ban vote. Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know. Well, Bradley Dean, your ass is going to burn in your personal hell, too. He wrote on his website, quote, before I knew it, instead of the media reporting on it, as me standing up for our future generations, all of a sudden I became an anti-gay divisive pastor. All of a sudden? The Republican Speaker of the House, Kurt Zellers, apologized for this freak's appearance and said he had failed to live up to his responsibility to uphold the decorum and dignity of the Minnesota House, right? Speaker Zellers denounced Dean and said, quote, that type of person will never be allowed on this House floor again as long as I have the honor of serving as your Speaker. Now, let's stop the queers from getting married. Yeah!
Tonight, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. I think today is Bob Alexander's birthday. We got a strange email from him today. I'd like to read it on the air, but I can't. Can't hear you, Kath. Yeah, well, Elaine Brulard's birthday is today, too. On my 50th birthday, Mike and Kathy, I'm glad to give back and sponsor our The Malloy Show. Two Seekers, let's support each other. Please sponsor an hour when you get the chance. From Elaine. Thank you, Elaine. Yeah, it's Bob Alexander's, it's not his 50th, though. From Prairie 2, the God Equation. Warm, humid air climbs the western slope of the Himalayas, building up heat until it chimneys up over the 30,000-foot peaks, and then chilled by the thin but intensely cold air above it, plunges partway down the slope at incredible speed until it levels off and heads east. And so the jet stream is born. It's called that because it was the age of jet airliners. Made it known to the general public. Flying in the jet stream can give you a 100-mile-per-hour tailwind, which was a boon to high-altitude travel. It really should be called the B-29 stream, as the bombers flying to Japan in 1944 were the first airplanes to encounter it. The Japanese had already figured it out, but weren't telling anybody, just launching fire balloons toward the United States. All of this energy can be plotted as a very complicated equation, and indeed, this is a big factor in long-range weather forecasting. Its path across the United States determines what sort of weather we have from day to day. Running further north than usual means heavy rains in the upper Midwest and summer flooding. It can produce heavy winter snow pack in places that don't normally get much snow. It snowed so much this winter that it ended a long-time drought in California, and that also changed the equation. The extra cold air coming off the snow is now pushing the jet stream further south than normal and setting up a conflict with historically warm, moist air coming up from the south. The equalizer of this clash is the thunderstorm, where warm air rises and being cooled discharges millions of tons of water, which creates devastating winds and lightning. When the upflow of air becomes unusually vigorous, it can create a vortex we call a tornado. The energy can't dissipate fast enough, and the wind just blows in a tight circle. Of course, a tight circle can be a mile across. This jet stream equation involves the topography of mountains and plains, cold high pressure air masses from the north, and hot wet air from the south. Over the decades, these numbers have many times produced tornadoes in and around Joplin, Missouri. This time, the numbers were particularly bad, producing an F4 tornado with winds just short of 200 miles an hour that cut a 3/4-mile-wide path through the center of town, leveling everything and wiping away 25% of the structures along a 6-mile corridor. The 7-story medical center that had served well in past storms took a direct hit this time and became a 5-story wreck surrounded by leveled and littered landscape with only the trunks of the largest trees protruding above ground. Ambulances arriving at the ER after the storm found that that wing of the hospital was simply gone. The death toll from this single storm exceeds anything in 65 years and is still counting. Climbing. The misery for Joplin is not over. The one thing that made this storm so bad is that the weather front is not moving, and more storms could continue for up to the next 3 days. Tomorrow is already forecasted to have the potential to repeat the same storm again. Damage from storms and flooding in the U.S. have already set a new record, running 5 times a typical year, and the hurricane season has yet to begin. It's a good thing that global warming is just a conspiracy among the scientific community and not really affecting the weather, or we'd be in real trouble. Those equations with the extra heat and moisture don't really mean anything. Just factor in some extra God, and we'll be all right. PrairieNumeral2.com. That's going to get you some answers there, Bruce. factor in some extra God, everything will be okay. One of the saddest things I heard, and I hate to even bring this up, because in a moment of panic and crisis, when the world is collapsing around you at 5:30 in the afternoon, who knows what a person would say, but the networks keep playing this piece of audio over and over and over again, people trapped inside a convenience store. And you can hear the panic and the shrieks and the crying and the little kids, which is particularly ugly and heartrending. And by the way, the people in this convenience store all survived. But in the midst of it, you hear an adult female voice calling out for Jesus over and over and over again.
Why don't the newscasters cry when they read about people who die? At least they could be decent enough to put just a tear in their eyes. But Mama said, it's just make-believe. You can't believe everything you see. So baby, close your eyes to the lullaby.
You are now entering a flying monkey-free zone.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Elaine Brulod. Hi, Mike and Kathy. On my 50th birthday, I'm glad to give back and sponsor an hour of the Mike Malloy Show. Truth seekers that support each other, please sponsor an hour when you get a chance. Brulod. Brulod, I think, is the way it's pronounced. Thanks, Elaine. A week or so ago, the right-wing piglets made a big deal about what I said about SEAL Team 6 visiting George W. Bush. Of course, I stand by that statement. I think it would be a good idea, not just Bush, but the rest of the thugs in his administration. But Noam Chomsky had a piece out about this. It's rather lengthy, but I want to quote a little bit from it here. I realize we're in an entirely different news cycle now, and the murder of bin Laden is so 2 weeks ago, and therefore out of the consciousness of the American people like it never happened, right? Who? Oh, Osama bin who? Let me jump right into the middle of what Chomsky wrote. It is worth adding that bin Laden's responsibility for 9/11 was recognized in much of the Muslim world and condemned. One significant example is the distinguished Lebanese cleric Sheikh Fadlallah, greatly respected by Hezbollah and Shia groups generally, outside Lebanon as well. He too had been targeted for assassination by a truck bomb outside a mosque in a CIA-organized operation in 1985. He escaped, but 80 others were killed, mostly women and girls, as they left the mosque. One of those innumerable crimes that do not enter the annals of terror because of the fallacy of wrong agency. Collateral damage. Sorry. Sheikh Fadlallah sharply condemned the 9/11 attacks, as did many other leading figures in the Muslim world, within the jihadi movement as well. Among others, the head of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, sharply condemned bin Laden and jihadi ideology. One of the leading specialists on the jihad movement, Fawaz Gerges, suggests that the jihad movement, might have been split at that time had the U.S. exploited the opportunity instead of mobilizing the movement, particularly by the attack on Iraq, a great boon to bin Laden, which led to a sharp increase in terror, as intelligence agencies had anticipated. That conclusion was confirmed by the former head of Britain's domestic intelligence agency, MI5, at the Chilcot, that's in Britain, hearings investigating the background for the war. Confirming other analyses, she testified that both British and U.S. intelligence were aware that Saddam Hussein posed no serious threat, and that that invasion was likely to increase terror, and that the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan had radicalized parts of a generation of Muslims who saw the military actions as an attack on Islam. As is often the case, security was not a high priority for state action here. It might be instructive to ask ourselves how we would be reacting if Iraqi commandos landed at George W. Bush's compound, assassinated him, and dumped his body in the Atlantic, after proper burial rites, of course. Uncontroversially, he is not a suspect, but the decider who gave the orders to invade Iraq, that is, to commit, quote, the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. That's quoting the Nuremberg Tribunal, for which Nazi criminals were hanged. In Iraq, the hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of refugees, destruction of most of the country and the national heritage, and the murderous sectarian conflict that has now spread to the rest of the region. Equally uncontroversially, these crimes vastly exceed anything attributed to bin Laden. To say that all this is uncontroversial, as it is not to imply that it is not denied. The existence of flat earthers does not challenge the fact that uncontroversially the earth is not flat. Similarly, it is uncontroversial that Stalin and Hitler were responsible for horrendous crimes, though their loyalists will deny it. All of this should again be too obvious for comment, and would be, except in an atmosphere of hysteria so extreme that it blocks rational thought. Similarly, it is uncontroversial that Bush and associates did commit the, quote, supreme international crime, end quote, the crime of aggression, at least if we take the Nuremberg Tribunal seriously. The crime of aggression was defined clearly enough by Justice Robert Jackson, chief of counsel for the United States at Nuremberg, reiterated in an authoritative General Assembly resolution. An aggressor, Jackson proposed to the tribunal in his opening statement, an aggressor is a state that is the first to commit such actions as invasion of its armed forces with or without a declaration of war or the territory of another state, end quote. No one, not even the most extreme supporter of the aggression, denies that Bush and associates did just that. We also might do well to recall Jackson's eloquent words at Nuremberg on the principle of universality. Quote, if certain acts of violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them. And we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others, which we would not be willing to have invoked against us, end quote. And elsewhere in his opening statement, Jackson said, quote, we must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poisoned chalice is to put it to our own lips as well, end quote. Chomsky goes on, it's also clear that alleged intentions are irrelevant. Japanese fascists apparently did believe that by ravaging China, they were laboring to turn it into, quote, an earthly paradise, end quote. We don't know whether Hitler believed that he was defending Germany from the wild terror, quote, of the Poles, or was taking over Czechoslovakia to protect its population from ethnic conflict and provide them with the benefits of a superior culture, or was saving the globe of the civilization of the Greeks from barbarians of the East and West, as his acolytes claimed. And it's even conceivable that Bush and company believed that they were protecting the world from destruction by Saddam's nuclear weapons. All irrelevant, though ardent loyalists on all sides may try to convince themselves otherwise. We are left with two choices. Either Bush and associates are guilty of the supreme international crime, including all the evils that follow, crimes that go vastly beyond anything attributed to bin Laden, or else we declare that the Nuremberg proceedings were a farce and that the Allies were guilty of judicial murder. Again, that is entirely independent of the question of the guilt of those charged. Established by the Nuremberg Tribunal in the case of the Nazi criminals, plausibly surmised from the outset in the case of bin Laden. A few days before the bin Laden assassination, Orlando Bosch died peacefully in Florida, where he resided, along with his terrorist accomplice Luis Posada Carriles and many others. After he was accused of dozens of terrorist crimes by the FBI, Bosch was granted a presidential pardon by Bush 1. Over the objections of the Justice Department, which found the conclusion, quote, inescapable, that it would be prejudicial to the public interest for the United States to provide a safe haven for Bosch. The coincidence of deaths at once calls to mind the Bush 2 doctrine, which has already become a de facto rule of international relations, according to the noted Harvard international relations specialist Graham Allison. The doctrine revokes the sovereignty of states that provide sanctuary to terrorists. Referring to the pronouncement of Bush 2 that, quote, those who harbor terrorists are as guilty as the terrorists themselves, which was directed at the Taliban. Such states, therefore, have lost their sovereignty and are fit targets for bombing and terror. For example, the state that harbored Bosch and his associate, not to mention some rather more significant candidates. When Bush issued this new de facto rule of international relations, no one seemed to notice that he was calling for invasion and destruction of the United States and the murder of its criminal presidents. My goodness, Noam Chomsky is just, well, there's a few more sentences that I'll share with you when we come back. But the enormity of what the Bush regime did and what Obama is continuing to do just seems to mean nothing. Nothing to anybody in this country, except maybe Noam Chomsky and a few other people. And instead of focusing this past weekend on the crimes, the war crimes, the destruction of the rule of law in this country by Bush and continuing by Obama, how much time was spent talking about the rapture?
When I saw their cities burning, I knew that I was learning. But I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leader's screaming when they close the missile plants. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason. Call it love or call it reason. But I ain't marching anymore.
Up America, one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Elaine Bouillard. Thanks, Elaine. His message. Hi, Mike and Kathy. On my 50th birthday, I'm glad to get back and sponsor an hour of the Malloy Show. True Seekers, let's support each other. Please sponsor an hour when you get the chance. Thanks, Elaine. Elaine. Appreciate it very much. As Chomsky said in this rather lengthy piece, there's much talk about bin Laden's so-called confession, but that was a boast, not a confession, with about as much credibility as my confession that I won the Boston Marathon. The boast about 9/11 tells us a lot about his character, but nothing about his responsibility for what he regarded as a great achievement, and for which he wanted to take credit. In closing out this lengthy piece, Chomsky says, what are the likely consequences of the killing of bin Laden? For the Arab world, it will probably mean little. He had long been a fading presence, and in the past few months was eclipsed by the Arab Spring. His significance in the Arab world is captured by the headline in the New York Times for an op-ed by Middle East al-Qaeda specialist Giles Keppel. The headline said, bin Laden was dead already. Keppel writes that few in the Arab world are likely to care the fact that he's dead. That headline might have been dated far earlier had the U.S. not mobilized the jihadi movement by the attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq. As for the jihadi movement, within it, bin Laden was doubtless a venerated symbol, but apparently did not play much more of a role for this network of networks, as analysts call it, which undertakes mostly independent operations. The most immediate and significant consequences are likely to be in Pakistan. There's much discussion of Washington's anger that Pakistan didn't turn over bin Laden. Less is said about the fury in Pakistan that the U.S. invaded their territory to carry out a political assassination. Anti-American fervor had already reached a very high peak in Pakistan, and these events are likely to exacerbate it. Pakistan is the most dangerous country on earth. Also, the world's fastest-growing nuclear power, with a huge arsenal. It is held together by one stable institution, the military. One of the leading specialists on Pakistan and its military, Anatole Lyvin, writes that if the, quote, U.S. ever puts Pakistani soldiers in a position where they felt that honor and patriotism required them to fight America, many would be very glad to do so, end quote. And if Pakistan collapsed, an absolutely inevitable result would be the flow of large numbers of highly trained ex-soldiers, including explosive experts and engineers, to extremist groups. That is the primary threat that he sees of leakage of fissile materials into jihadi hands, a horrendous eventuality. The Pakistani military have already been pushed to the edge by U.S. attacks on Pakistani sovereignty. One factor is the drone attacks in Pakistan that Obama escalated immediately after the killing of bin Laden, rubbing salt in the wounds. But there's much more, including the demand that the Pakistani military cooperate in the U.S. war against the Afghan Taliban, whom the overwhelming majority of Pakistanis, the military included, see as fighting a just war of resistance against an invading army. The U.S. There is much more to say, but even the most obvious and elementary facts should provide us with a good deal to think about. Barack Obama, by his actions, not by the rhetoric of any of these freaks on the right, Barack Obama has identified himself by definition as a war criminal. Even where it concerns the War Powers Act that gave Obama the power to invade another country, Libya, the War Powers Act requires within 60 days taking that invasion and the decision to make that invasion to Congress, where Congress authorizes it, within 60 days. That 60 days passed last week, and not a sound, not a peep from anybody, not in the major media, not from Congress, and not from Obama or anyone in his administration. The continued extrajudicial killings, the continued presence of U.S. military in two countries that we invaded in contravention of the Geneva Accords, in contravention of the very law we cast in lead where it concerned the trials in Nuremberg. Those actions have identified George Bush and everyone in his administration and Barack Obama and everyone in his administration as war criminals. There is no way around that. I don't care how many liberal or progressive talk show hosts try to tell you differently. Either the Nuremberg decisions meant something or they didn't. If they didn't mean anything, then the United States, Great Britain, France, and Russia are guilty of using an international tribunal to commit murder. the Nazi high command, and using the same laws to commit murder in Japan, the Japanese high command. Either the rules we set out mean something or they don't. But whenever someone tells you, I mean, my God, Erica, what's his name, at the Nation said that Obama or bin Laden, the killing of bin Laden was justified and acceptable. So Eric Alterman joins that list of right wing or left wing so-called liberal or progressive commentators who have decided on their own that Barack Obama is exempt from the very rules that they would apply to George Bush and did apply to the Nazis. Go figure.
That's a great take.
I'll do it at the bottom of the hour because it may be the first little bit of proof that the so-called birthers, or I'm sorry, birthers, where did that come? Oh, I'm just reading something here about these sick bastards, that the 9/11 truthers just may be right. That's going to, you know, the mere thought that the people who have held out for a decade, that the story about what happened on September 11, 2001, had never been told. The real story had not been told. That the story put out there for public consumption was a fabrication. And a lot of the hardcore 9/11 truth people have really taken a beating. They're dismissed as freaks, morons, kooks, conspiracy theorists, half-wits. Just go right down the list. Now, they're dismissed that way by their critics. But there was something at Truth Out today that I want to share with you when we a little bit later into this hour. This hour, by the way, is sponsored by Jim Jones. His message, please, Lord, call them home on the 21st. They have been destroying your creation for far too long in your name. And please, please take rat bastard Pat Robertson, too. Get these people out of our hair. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, but today's the 23rd. Well, okay. But this is what Jim's message was. Thanks, Jim, for the sponsorship. There was a high school prom last Saturday night in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Santa Fe, of all places. This is what, I couldn't believe this. Santa Fe High School, the prom. And the school administrators had called in the TSA, Transportation Safety Administration, the people who pat you down and play with your body parts at airports as you go through security. The school administration apparently had called in, had asked for a certified TSA official to be on hand to check out kids going to a high school prom. The article says this all comes after two Capital High School students, sisters, filed a lawsuit saying they were groped by a security agent at Capital High School's prom. On Friday, the court ordered Santa Fe Public Schools and the security company ASI to provide at least one TSA-certified person at the Santa Fe High School prom and the Capital High School graduation. KOB Channel 4 Eyewitness News in Santa Fe talked to one of the sisters suing the district earlier this week. The sister said, quote, she, referring to the TSA person, she grabbed my breast and shook the inner part of my bra and shook it, or took the inner part of my bra and shook it, and then picked up the front of my dress to mid-thigh, and she was patting down my bare legs. Now, the follow-up to the story, this was middle of last week, the follow-up was that the school system backed down. And instead of TSA officials, they had state police there. Jesus H. Christ. State police at a high school? What is the threat in Santa Fe? I mean, I don't know. Was there some horrible threat at this high school?
Well, they might have had an illegal immigrant hiding under their dress.
Yeah, but this is Santa Fe, New Mexico, the hug capital, the new age capital, the spiritual, what do you call those places where magic comes out of the ground? What are those called? What is that called? Somebody help me.
Disney World?
No. What's the portal?
Wireless hotspot?
No, portals of some sort. What the hell? What is it called? I can't think of the term. These portals of energy.
Peyote?
Vortexes, something. You know, who was the guy who had the overnight program all those years ago? What was his name?
That would be Art Bell.
Yeah, Art Bell used to talk about the they were vortexes or something. I don't know. I forget how I got off on that. Never mind. Just never mind. Here's an example of union strength. This is at alternet.org. As a morality tale about abuse of power and the abuse of the powerful, the fall from grace of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, former chief of the International Monetary Fund. This is a man who once ranked among the world's most powerful, and he spent about a week sitting in a jail cell on Rikers Island, all because an immigrant woman in a lowly position had the temerity to tell a superior that one of her employer's very important clients, what he had done. And by her account, they were terrible things to her. Now, by any measure, it was a risky thing to do. An immigrant, not very well versed in the rules and laws here, certainly not the rules and laws here as it apply to rich people, or people of power, I should say, since DSK was not all that rich. It's his wife that's rich. But there's a reason that most rapes go unreported. There was one thing that housekeeper knew could not be done to her for reporting her account. She could not be fired for having done so because the contract between her union, the New York Hotel Trades Council, and the Sofitel Hotel at which she works, there was a union contract that stated categorically that were a situation of this sort to arise, and one of the hired help filed a complaint, went to management. Management, no matter who the alleged perp was, management could not fire that person, as is normally the case. You know as well as I do. Somebody walks into a hotel like DSK with all of his power and tries to rape a chambermaid. And what happens when that, or a chamberman, what happens when that person, that domestic, goes to management? The domestic is usually told, here's $100, get out of here. But because she worked in a union shop, Herman Cain, Godfather's Pizza. I'll tell you what, Georgia, here in Georgia, we produce more half-wits. And not all of them are white. Sometimes we produce black half-wits here, too, political half-wits. Herman Cain is one of those. He's the former CEO of Godfather's Pizza, right? And he had a talk show on an extreme right-wing station here in Atlanta, the same right-wing station that has employed Neil Bortz for the past 20 years. But Herman Cain has announced that he's going to be a candidate. He is a candidate for the Republican nomination for president. And he had a response to a question about national security policy. Where was it? Oh, he was on Fox News Sunday. This is the way it's reported. GOP, oh, wait a minute, got a break here? Okay, let's do the break and we'll come back. Herman Cain, look him up during the break. What a moron. What a half-witted moron. Another one. There must be a requirement in order to be a Republican, whether you're black, white, gay, straight, Jew, Gentile, makes no difference. You have to first and foremost be a half-witted moron.
Time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Herman Cain is a former radio talk show host, right-wing nutcase here in Georgia. And like Alan Keyes, just because somebody has dark skin doesn't mean that they are blessed by the Almighty with wisdom and insight, right? Anyway, Herman Cain, former CEO of Godfather's Pizza, is now declared he's going to run for the Republican nomination for president. As Michael in New Mexico says, you realize that Herman Cain is just like Alan Keyes, with extra cheese. I don't know why I think that's funny. Anyway, Herman Cain was on the Rupert Murdoch terrorist television network on Sunday, and he was asked what his plan was for the war on terror and how to conduct that war. Now, rather than just coming out and saying, having a war, declared war on a concept that gives us the right to invade countries at will in violation of every agreement the United States has ever been party to, is something I don't choose to do. You know, kind of like Ron Paul would say. Too bad Ron Paul is clinically insane. He happens to be sane on a couple of issues, but he's clinically insane on everything else. But rather than say that, he told Murdoch's terrorist Sunday morning program, quote, the right approach is that the day I'm elected, I will start on that plan. When asked if he had a plan, how's he going to? He's going to start on the day he's elected. He says he can't make any decision until he sees intelligence files that he is not privy to at this point. Well, you almost got to sit back and say, you know, he's probably right about that. But this isn't the first time Cain has pleaded ignorance on foreign policy. During the candidates' debate in South Carolina earlier this month, he gave a largely incoherent response to a question about Afghanistan. And this is the one that was sponsored by the Rupert Murdoch terrorist organization, the Fox Network. He was asked by Chris Wallace a question about the Palestinian right of return. In other words, do the Jews have a right of return to Israel? Do the Palestinians have a right of return to Palestine, if ever such a place is fully established? Wallace, where do you stand on the right of return? Cain, the right of return? The right of return? Wallace, the Palestinian right of return? Cain, that's something that should be negotiated. That's something that should be negotiated. And the obvious thing, this is a presidential campaign, not amateur hour, saying, I don't know, or worse, displaying complete ignorance on an issue that everybody has been talking about since Obama's Middle East speech last Thursday. It clearly indicates that McCain, like so many, or Cain, not McCain, but Cain, Herman Cain, Cain's qualifications for being president are the same as Sarah Palin's, or worse. Good Lord. Just never stops, does it? Well, there's another one. From here, Rob Woodall, a Georgia Republican, he made a vigorous defense of ending Medicare as it currently exists. He was at a local town hall here in Georgia, and he told seniors that they ought not look to the government to provide health care for the elderly just because their private employer doesn't offer health benefits for retirees. Let me explain. He was at this meeting, this town hall meeting, and a constituent raised a practical obstacle to obtaining coverage in the private market within the confines of an employer-based health insurance system. She said, "What happens when you retire?" The woman said, "The private corporation that I retired from doesn't give medical benefits to retirees." And this piece of human waste, Rob Woodall, Georgia Republican representative, he said to the woman, "Hear yourself, ma'am, hear yourself. You want the government to take care of you because your employer decided not to take care of you. My question is, when do you decide you're going to take care of you?" Large portions of the crowd, according to what I have here, large portions of the crowd responded enthusiastically to the congressman's smart-ass remark. Some of them gave him a standing ovation. Now, here's a woman who lives in his district with a legitimate question. What happens if I retire and my income goes way down and the company I've worked for does not have a retiree health insurance package, and there's no Medicare? What do I do? Let me tell you what he said when we come back. A little bit more of what he said. All night long, but you just want to sit and listen to the radio. Before the hour. So, here in Georgia, We have this right-wing nutcase who, you know, follows the dictates of Grover Norquist to strangle the social safety net, reduce it until it's small enough to be drowned in a bathtub. So the representative here, Rob Woodall, Georgia Republican, William Robert Woodall III. He doesn't appear to have been referring literally to himself when he said, "My question is, when do I decide I'm going to take care of me rather than rely on somebody else to pay your health insurance or to provide you with health insurance?" It's a good thing he wasn't referring to himself, because financial records show that this 41-year-old punk has done very little to take care of himself in his retirement. His 2009 financial disclosure forms, filed with the House of Representatives, show that his two largest IRAs have between $15,000 and $50,000 worth of assets. Hardly the type of nest egg that would be able to cover the health care costs associated with aging if he didn't have government health care. Now, this halfwit, Rob Woodall, was the chief of staff to former Representative John Linder, another Republican ghoul from Georgia. That's a job as chief of staff. This Woodall got paid more than $100,000 a year in 2002, and then it went to $150,000 a year in 2009. Plus, he got gold-plated health and retirement benefits. Woodall, the punk, who has taken his former boss's seat, now makes $174,000 a year with generous health benefits, right? Another woman at this town hall meeting told the congressman that it was unrealistic to think that the market would provide affordable policies to the elderly. She said, this other woman said, quote, "When you become a senior, you will not be created equal when they take away your Medicare." Another woman told the congressman that Medicare provides peace of mind to her children, who would be on the hook for her care otherwise, much as they were before the social safety net was stitched together for older people. The woman said, quote, "I'm fine with my Medicare and my children and my children especially. They would have a lot of heartburn if they know I'm not on Medicare, because that voucher is not going to go very far." That's the voucher that these Republican halfwits are telling old people that they should, not old people, people in their 60s, that they should have rather than Medicare, right? Woodall suggested that the woman concerned about vouchers might find the type of health care system she and her children approve of in Canada. He said, "If you want a socialized health care program, a lot of places to find that. But for your children's sake, I'm telling you, there aren't many places to find the freedom to succeed by the sweat of your brow like we have here." Which was not the issue. This is why the Republicans are, not that I really give a damn so much, but the Republicans are going to lose control of the U.S. House in the election coming up in 2012. There's no question about it. You know, this piece of human waste could have proposed clubbing grandma, and this crowd that he was addressing would still cheer, the ones that stood up and cheered. All they know is they're supporting someone who's against Obama, Woodall. And it doesn't matter if he's, it doesn't matter what he's, actually proposing. He's just against Obama. So these halfwits here in Georgia, these white people, just stand up and almost pee their pants. They're so happy to see somebody. That's another reason Kane doesn't have a chance here in Georgia. I don't care how right-wing he is. Oh, God. I don't know. You imagine some 41-year-old punk saying to retired people, you know, telling these retired people, "Listen, we're going to take away as much of the social safety net as we can. We're going to go back into the 60s and destroy Medicare. And if you don't like it, move to Canada." What a bunch of bastards. What hasn't been discussed, this is a truth out, is a September 2008, this is before Obama got elected, September 2008 Department of Defense Inspector General report summarizing an investigation made in response to an accusation by a whistleblower with the Joint Forces Intelligence Command. The whistleblower indicated that a senior commander had halted actions tracking Osama bin Laden prior to 9/11. Now, the Joint Forces Intelligence Command, is their job is as an intelligence operation in support of the United States Joint Force Command, if you can keep all that straight. The Joint Force Intelligence Command, the Joint Force Command. The latter is military, the former is intelligence. The report was declassified last year in response to a Freedom of Information Act request by someone named Stephen Aftergood at the Federation of American Scientists. The report was titled Review of Joint Forces Intelligence Command Response to 9/11 Commission. Remember the 9/11 Commission? The whistleblower, who the Inspector General identified as a former Joint Forces Intelligence Command employee, is represented only by his code name, Iron Man. Iron Man claimed in letters written to both the Department of Defense Inspector General in May 2006 that the Joint Forces Intelligence Command had withheld operational information about Al-Qaeda. When asked in March 2002 about its activities by the Defense Intelligence Administration, the DIA, and higher command officials on behalf of the 9/11 Commission, what all this gets down to is that according to this report, the 9/11 Commission had not requested the direct submission of any files or requested information regarding the tracking of Osama bin Laden. And it turns out that the tracking of Osama bin Laden had been ordered stopped as far back as prior to the attack on this country. Even though the Bush administration had gotten memo after memo after memo saying things that Al-Qaeda or bin Laden determined to strike in the United States. The order to stop tracking bin Laden came sometime between 1999 and just after 9/11, 2001. Earlier this year, a writer named Susan Dow, who's been following the story about a U.S. Army contractor in Iraq who disappeared on the road between Tikrit and Kirkuk in October 2003, she asserted that this was not the first time that someone who had information about ordering the U.S. intelligence agencies off the trail of Osama bin Laden. This is not the first time it happened. As a matter of fact, people who knew this story were disappearing, were being killed. This is something the 9/11 truthers have been talking about for years. A guy named Ryan Manelik, a former Air Force intelligence officer, was shot and killed outside a U.S. military base near Baghdad. He had told various people that he was in fear of his life. He had worked for the contractor Ulta Services, based in Turkey, and had information about why and how the U.S. intelligence community was pulled off of the task of tracking Osama bin Laden. The 9/11 Commission, I think all of us can agree, that except the crazy people in this country, that would be the right-wingers, we can all agree that the 9/11 Commission was a hoax, a myth, a sham. It was bull hockey of the highest order. But there are these intelligence reports circulating now, and a couple of them have been made public, redacted but made public through Freedom of Information Act, intelligence reports that show that various times during the Bush crime family, criminal activity, war crime administration in this country, that the intelligence communities were directed to stay away from anything about Osama bin Laden. Now, I've said before, on this program that while I can't get my mind around yet the idea that the Bush crime family made these attacks happen on September 11, 2001, I am pretty much convinced they allowed them to happen through their incompetence or through deliberate withholding of any means or method of warning people or stopping it from happening. I believe that as firmly as I believe that today is Monday. There is no way in hell that that operation could have happened the way it happened without either active or passive complicity on the part of the Bush crime family. And now it turns out that there is a paper trail. I wonder if the entire paper trail will ever be made visible. And I wonder if the Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and the rest of these war criminals will still be alive where they can be prosecuted. And I wonder if there will be a president of the United States who will order the prosecution.
It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Jim Jones. His message, please, Lord, call them home on the 21st. They have been destroying your creation for far too long in your name. And please, please take that rat bastard Pat Robertson, too. Get these people out of our hair. Well, Jim, it just didn't work out that way, did it? But anyway, thanks for the sponsorship, pal. I appreciate it. Wouldn't it be what's the word I'm looking for? A shock? I guess that underplays to find out that the people who have been insisting that what happened on September 11, 2001 was a result of either action taken by or action not taken by the Bush crime family, and that the whole thing could have been prevented except for the fact that the Bush administration wanted a massive terrorist attack on this country so that they could implement their 10-year plan. Which is what we are in right now. The invasion of countries in violation of just about every, the whole Iraq adventure. Even you half-witted right-wingers out there who listen to this program, even you dumbasses, surely there is some little beam of light that gets into your addled, Rush Limbaugh, jiggled brains that tells you that the invasion of Iraq was exactly the same as Hitler's invasion of Poland. There is no difference. None. And as such, according to the tribunal, the military, the hearings, the cases that were decided after World War II, that went on for 4 years? When did the Nuremberg Commission finally close down? Don't send me an email. I know it was 3 years. But the conclusions were that the action taken by Adolf Hitler were the worst possible crime that could be committed in international law. The Holocaust? No, not the Holocaust. That was a result of Hitler's crime. The crime was the unprovoked invasion of another country and the slaughter of its citizens. What did George W. Bush do? You rat bastards on the right who have the absolute gall to send me your filthy emails when I point out that George W. Bush is more of a war criminal than Bin Laden could ever be in his wildest fantasies. God damn you people. Are you so stupid? You are the ones who are a threat to this country. You are the ones who would bring it down. You are the ones, you right-wing bastards, you are the ones who would destroy the United States. You have no respect for the rule of law, no respect for our Constitution, no respect for any of the treaties and agreements that we signed and brought into effect as a result of fascism back in the 30s and 40s. You right-wingers, you Republicans, you teabaggers, you are a threat to this country, and damn you for it. You disgusting freaks, if you would take 10 minutes to sit down and clear your minds, if it's possible, to what Bush did and now Obama is continuing to do, you dumb bastards. Maybe it would sink into your heads what has happened here. But no. Never going to happen. You have your little stupid-ass rapture rumor floating around for a couple of months. That didn't happen. Where are you people who would have the filth to point out, and I'm sure some of you would, that all this tornadic death and destruction is ripping across the very part of the country that is so caught up in right-wing nonsense? Is your God punishing people for their political beliefs? That's what you call down on liberals. That's what you call down on progressives or union members or gay folk or anyone else that your sick, insane political philosophy doesn't agree with. Well, guess what? It appears that your God is getting sick of you. You think maybe this is what Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell said after the attack on September 11th? Well, you know, God dropped his protective veil because of the feminists and the progressives and the liberals and the gay people. And this is a result. You sick sons of bitches. You really are. You really, really are sick. Why don't you try to get well? Why don't you just, for, I don't know, a month, a year, 5 years, before your ass dies, why don't you try to clear out your minds just once and see the world for what it is instead of what these pigs on radio and television persist in telling you it is? Why don't you just try just once, 10 minutes, 1 week, a day, just try. Never mind. The hell am I talking about? Asking you people to clear your mind of the right-wing garbage is like asking you to, walk on water, right? You morons. It's just irritating. You know, ignorance is one thing, but gross, monumental, cataclysmic stupidity is something else again. We'll be back after the break. This is Malloy's show. You know, I get a lot of hate mail, but now I'm getting hate mail through the regular mail. This comes from John Anders, A-N-D-E-R-S, Jr., on Willow Hearth Drive in Houston, Texas. John Anders, Willow Hearth Drive in Houston, Texas. He writes, Mike Mallory. Ooh, I'm insulted. Ooh, that's right. When somebody sends me an email, it says Mikey. Ooh, that hurts so bad. Oh, don't call me Mr. Mallory or Mikey. Anyway, John Anders of Houston, Texas writes, question, where does the hatred for your country and its countrymen come from? What a horrible person you must be to have such hatred in your heart. I was under the impression that liberals like you are compassionate, understanding individuals. Guess I was mistaken. Tell me, did you have trouble as an infant mastering potty training? Or were you bullied in school, which resulted in such a vile contempt for your fellow countrymen? Quite frankly, I have never heard of you. But you being on defunct and irrational Air America answers that question. Please feel free to attach the enclosed bumper sticker to your Prius or Volt. I am sure as a hypercritical liberal you own one. And the bumper sticker is, liberalism is indeed a mental disorder. Oh, John Anders on Willow Hearth Drive in Houston, Texas. You just cut me to the quick. Oh, I'm bleeding! I'm bleeding! Oh, my God. Go to get in your Prius or your Volt. That's what you rotten-ass liberals drive, right? Actually, I have a pickup truck, punk, with a gun rack in the back. This hour is sponsored by Kathleen Spendlove. Message from Norman and Kathleen. True believers. And faithfully hoping you'll be on the air forever. Unless we're all fried by now. We're not, Kathleen. We're not fried. Norman and Kathleen, thank you for the sponsorship. I guess, well, obviously these had to come in before today, right, Kathy? That's why, unless we're all fried by now. No, we're here. Norman and Kathleen, thanks. Thanks for the sponsorship. Okay, are you ready? You're sitting down for this? I just got a bulletin from Sheila. California preacher Harold Camping. He said that his prophecy that the world would end was off by 5 months because Judgment Day actually is going to come on October 21st. This is at MSNBC's website. Camping said he felt terrible when his doomsday prediction did not come true. Isn't that just like one of these sick, crazy fundamentalists? Well, I'm real sorry the earth wasn't destroyed. I just felt terrible. He said he felt so terrible when his doomsday prediction did not come true that he left home and took refuge in a motel with his wife. His independent ministry, Family Radio International, spent millions of dollars. Donations from his brain-injured followers. No offense to people who are really, I'm talking about people who are spiritually brain-injured because they listen to this garbage. 5,000 billboards. 20 RVs plastered with the Judgment Day. Well, guess what? Harold was off by a couple of months. Camping said he now realizes the apocalypse will come 5 months after May 21st. He had earlier said October 21st was when the globe would be consumed by a fireball. Now, last Saturday, what was last Saturday? Well, Truthsaker, that was an invisible Judgment Day. You missed it. See, what happened was a spiritual judgment took place. He said, quote, we've always said May 21st was the day, but we didn't understand altogether the spiritual meaning. May 21st is the day that Christ came and put the world under judgment.
Ah. Oh, I see.
Okay. Uh-huh. When the rapture didn't arrive Saturday, crestfallen, or is that chestfallen, crestfallen followers of Mr. Camping began turning their attention to more earthly concerns, it says here. Here's one. Jeff Hopkins had figured the gas money he spent driving back and forth from Long Island to New York City would be worth it as long as people could see the ominous sign atop his car warning that the end of the world was nigh. He said, quote, "I've been mocked and scoffed and cursed at, and I've been through a lot with this lighted sign on top of my car." Lighted sign? He's 52, a former television producer, lives in Great River, New York. He said, "I was doing what I've been instructed to do through the Bible, but now I've been stymied. It's like getting slapped in the face." Well, don't worry. Don't worry, Mr. Hopkins. Harold now says it's, you know, just 5 months off. It'll be October 21st. Okay? Anyway, back to Mr. Camping. He said family radio would never tell anyone who what they should do with their possessions, you know, because a lot of people gave everything away and quit their jobs and sold everything and gave the money to, I don't know, to their bookie or their crack dealer or whatever. Camping said, what people do with their possessions is between them and God. But he said he wouldn't give away all his possessions before October 21st. He said, quote, "I still have to live in a house. I still have to drive a car. What would be the value of that? If it's Judgment Day, why would I give it away?" One of those dense theological questions, right? This is the kind that rabbis could examine for the next 1,500 years to find an answer. So what do you think is the answer? I don't know. I don't know. What did he say again? He said, "I have to live in a house. I have to drive a car. What would be the value of that? If it's Judgment Day, why would I give it away?" Well, let's go back to the book of Ezekiel. There may be, no, how about Deuteronomy? There may be a clue. What did David's, I don't know. Did Solomon have it? If it's Judgment Day, why would I give it away? Oh, my God. In 2009, the nonprofit Family Radio reported in IRS filings that it received $18 million in donations that year, had assets of more than $104 million, including $34 million in stocks or other publicly traded securities. So, be calmed, be pacified, brethren and sistren, because Harold just had it wrong by a few months. The destruction of the world and the rapture. Now, there are religions that tell you only 144,000 people are going to make it into heaven, but Harold said 200 million. Man, he must have some kind of a translation key that translates the ancient Aramaic or the ancient Hebrew or the ancient, I don't know, something that the rest of the biblical scholars are not privy to. Oh, well. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Progressive Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. This hour is sponsored by Norman and Kathleen, true believers and faithful, hoping you'll be on the air forever, unless we're all fried by now. Ta-da! Here's an interesting letter I got. Mike, here's why I can't believe Bin Laden was the target of Sunday night's operation. If you remember a press interview with Benazir Bhutto a couple of weeks before her assassination, she said something about Bin Laden being dead. I'm paraphrasing. 2 weeks or so later, she paid for exposing that the boogeyman who legitimized the emptying of the U.S. Treasury into the coffers of greedy war contractors with her life. Knowing Dick Cheney's penchant for blood money, death, and all things unsavory, it's not a far stretch that he'd send his hit squad to murder Bhutto, the whistleblower, just like the lab technician who was labeled the one and only conspirator in the anthrax mailing, and the D.C. madam who threatened to expose U.S. members of Congress on her client list. Both of those people conveniently hanged themselves before they could elaborate on their convictions. And let's not forget Timothy McVeigh and Saddam Hussein, both executed almost immediately after their convictions, leaving no opportunity for either of them to expose a conspiracy or to remind us about where Saddam got the weapons he used to commit the crimes he was hanged for. How convenient. This is a handwritten letter of snail mail. How convenient we've been shown no photographs of a dead Bin Laden, and a burial at sea prevents any doubts or questions about this evidence from ever coming to bear. And please, let's not forget that there are no three families on earth closer than the Saudi royal family, the Bin Laden family, and the Bush family. Let's not forget that Osama was made a CIA asset so we could fight the Russians by proxy in Afghanistan back in 79. Let's not forget that it was the U.S. that created al-Qaeda as an offshoot of the Mujahideen, and that Salim bin Laden funded Arbusto. That was George Bush's oil company. I could just imagine a phone call to Osama from W saying, "Hey, Osama, we can take the Saudis' biggest oil competitors out of the game if your dad can convince the House of Saud to send a bunch of crazies to create our new Pearl Harbor. And B, if you'll agree to be our boogeyman. Don't worry about them being in on the no-fly list. We'll have that lifted. We'll make sure they get visas and all the proper documents, and we'll connect the whole thing with your mortal enemy, Saddam Hussein. What do you say, Osama, old buddy?" So he was allowed to escape from Tora Bora. At least one retired MI6 admitted he was told to stand down when he had Bin Laden in his crosshairs. And even though 15 of the 19 attackers were Saudis, we did not declare war on Saudi Arabia. Why not? Because you don't declare war on your friends who enabled your emptying of the U.S. Treasury. A missile hole in the Pentagon, no debris field in Shanksburg, thermite in the Twin Tower rubble, Building 7, my head is about to explode. Hank in Hollywood, Florida. Please, P.S., if Osama's dead, can I please have my rights back now? All right. That's from Hank, who also said, using snail mail because I can't have an email like this traced back to my computer. Okay, well, Hank, thanks for writing. I appreciate it. Yeah, the D.C. madam, remember her? Her body was found in, Tarpon Springs, Florida. Killed herself. Remember she had a list of all sorts of, that was Senator David Vitter of Louisiana. He was exposed. Wasn't he reelected? And then he stood out there with his poor ashen-faced wife, another Republican. A former employee of the D.C. madam, Brandy Britton, hanged herself before going to trial. Oh, God, all these people that hang themselves. kill themselves because they have information about what? I mean, my goodness. But I still have, I have friends, people I know, who ask me if I'm ever going to stop acting like an ignorant child or a conspiracy nut and just accept the fact that what happened on 9/11 happened the way it was presented. I'm reminded of something Captain Mary in Memphis sent me one time. It's a quote from, I forget who it's from, but here's the quote. Fairy tales weren't written to tell children that dragons exist. Children know that dragons exist. Fairy tales were written to tell children that dragons can be killed. We'll be back in a minute.
Bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Norman and Kathleen, true believers and faithful, faithfully hoping you'll be on the air forever. Oh, we'll be on the air forever. Unless we're all fried by now. We're not, Norman and Kathleen. It comes October 21st, not May 21st. Can't you people get it right? This Harold Camping, I'm going to make a prediction. I think he will die between now and October 21st. I do. I think he's going to keel over with a massive coronary or some sort of rapidly developing cancer or a massive burst blood vessel in his brain. Or maybe a triple A. What is that? Aortic, acute aortic aneurysm. Bang! When those hit, at his age, you're usually dead before you hit the floor. So I would think that Harold Camping, the Reverend, that's my prediction. He's predicting the end of everything and people are going to burn. I'm predicting that he'll be dead before October 21st. Let's see which one of us is right. This caught my eye last week. Didn't get a chance to get to it. It was in Bloomberg. There was a lawsuit filed by hospitals in Missouri. And the hospitals were seeking about $500 million in damages, against about 40 Missouri hospitals filed the suit against Philip Morris, the Philip Morris unit of the Altria Group, the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, the Lorillard Tobacco Company, and other cigarette makers 11 years ago. Is that 1998? That was 11 years ago. No, that's 13 years ago. Come on, Mike. 13 years ago, they filed this claim. Finally, a jury issued their verdict, and the jury decided that the tobacco companies are not liable. to Missouri hospitals for money spent on patients with smoking-related illnesses who could not pay their medical bills. A St. Louis jury decided that. This is the part I don't understand. There is not a rational human being on earth who doesn't understand that smoking cigarettes causes disease and death. Of all sorts. It's not just lung cancer. Come on. Lung cancer is just the most direct pathway between smoking and death. Lung cancer. And yes, there are other things that cause lung cancer, but that we're not talking about other things. We're talking about cigarette smoking. So many cancers are brought about by smoking. Blood diseases, cancers, strokes, heart attacks, heart disease. I mean, just what I read the other day. We're approaching 500,000 deaths per year in this country, which I guess is okay unless it's your mom or your dad or your brother or your aunt or your nephew who dies of smoking-related disease. 500,000 people. The cynics would say, well, it's a good population. It thins out the gene pool. Okay, go ahead. Be a cynical bastard. Go ahead. But why do people not understand this jury? I wonder how many people on the jury are cigarette smokers. I wonder. Anyway, the jury says, nope, these tobacco companies are not responsible for the money that these hospitals in Missouri spent treating indigent people, or people that could not afford, didn't have to be indigent, I added that word, treating people who could not afford to pay their hospital bills, who were in hospital for smoking-related death, disease, and death. The hospitals argued that the tobacco industry's actions had raised spending for unreimbursed and uncompensated tobacco-related health care. It was the tobacco industry's actions. I mean, there's a direct... Oh, well. The tobacco companies denied any responsibility. Yeah, no, we don't have wood. What are you talking about? Cigarette smoking? Cancer? What? Who? Where? Somebody? Who said that? The jury agreed with the tobacco industry, and it was a jury in St. Louis. The jury rejected the hospital's claim on a 9-3 vote a couple of weeks ago. It was the seventh day of deliberations. Took them 7 days to come to a 9-3 decision that once again, tobacco companies, the tobacco industry, is not responsible. The Associate General Counsel for Altria Client Services. Doesn't that sound just like wonderful? That really is tobacco. That's Philip Morris. Altria Client. So, sounds like altruism. Sounds like altitude. Sounds like, you know, something really nice. The Associate General Counsel for Altria Client Services, Murray Garnick, said in a statement, quote, the jury correctly rejected the entirety of the hospital's claims. The jury agreed with Philip Morris that ordinary cigarettes are not negligently designed or defective. What? This is a lawyer making a statement. Ordinary cigarettes are not negligently designed or defective. Notice the rat squirming reality of that statement. They're not. He's absolutely right. They're not negligently designed. They're designed to kill you. They're not defective. What's defective about a product that is absolutely designed to fill your lungs with poison and kill you? What's defective? That's what it's designed for. Cigarettes and guns are the only two things I can think of in this country. I'm sure there's more, but cigarettes and guns, the only two things designed specifically to kill you. Right? So Murray, the Associate General Counsel for the cancer-inducing Altria Client Services, said, you know, well, ordinary cigarettes are not negligently designed or defective. The hospitals haven't yet decided whether to appeal. That's according to their lawyer. Now, this case is the third of its type. It's referred to as a cost recovery claim. The third one to reach trial. The tobacco industry won the first in Ohio in 1999. The second one resulted in a $17 million award to a health insurer by a New York jury in 2001, but on appeal, that decision was reversed in 2004. The Missouri trial, which did not include patients as plaintiffs, this was a suit brought by the hospitals. It went on trial in January. So the tobacco industry gets a 3-for-3. They're batting 1,000. Once again, wasn't there a settlement a few years back? Who's our friend in Ring of Fire who was... Yeah, Mike Papantonio. He was one of the attorneys that handled that massive multi-billion dollar lawsuit that went to the states. The states were supposed to use it for things that they didn't use it for. They used it, it went into their general fund. It was supposed to be designated for to help offset the costs of the death and destruction caused by the tobacco industry. Remember that? And it was massive, hundreds of billions of dollars, wasn't it? Or 70 billion, 80 billion, I don't know. A lot of money. So here we are all these years later, and Murray Garnick, Associate General Counsel for Altria, says that ordinary cigarettes are not negligently designed or defective. And we're going to keep selling them, and you dumb bastards are going to keep smoking them, and you're going to keep dying, and we don't care. Your lungs are going to bleed, your guts are going to bleed, your brains are going to just collapse, your heart is going to stop pumping, but we don't care. We're tobacco. To put us out of business would be a job killer. It would result in a loss of tax dollars. Oh, my God. You know, who would have thought that we're still talking about this dumbass subject all these years later? Wasn't there a law just passed in New York that bans smoking outside now? In parks, you know, public places outside. You can't smoke outside. You can't smoke inside. And a lot of people in New York smoke. We'll be right back.
Invented a cigarette. Well, I murdered that son of a gun in the first degree. Now, when eight goes that, I don't smoke myself, and I don't reckon that they hinder your health. You know, I've been smoking all of my life, and I ain't dead yet. But nicotine slaves are all the same. At a party or a poker game, everything's got to stop while they have that cigarette. Tell St. Peter that folks and geeks, you just hate to make it wait. You gotta have another cigarette.
Tip before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Norman and Kathleen. Thank you, Norman. Thank you, Kathleen. They are true believers and faithfully hoping we'll be on the air here forever, unless we're all fried by now. No, we're not, Kathleen. That's coming up in October. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Norman. Appreciate it. All right, Cindy. Blue Lady just sent me a link here to a report. It's at Citizens for Legitimate Government, CLG.org. And also it's at, what I've got here is the India Times. Is it the India Times? India Today. It's from New Delhi. WikiLeaks. This is dated May 23rd. That's like today, right? Yesterday in India. WikiLeaks has revealed that the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, had refused, U.S. Embassy, had refused to provide security to former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto months before her assassination in December 2008, despite her personal requests to U.S. members of Congress. The article goes on to say it's no secret that Bhutto faced threat from extremist forces, including the Taliban. In fact, her very return to Pakistan on October 18, 2007, resulted in a suicide attack on her motorcade at Karachi that killed 140 people, remember that? Mostly her supporters and activists within her party. Bhutto survived the attack. It's obvious she was the target. Subsequently, Bhutto said she did not trust the state apparatus because she thought it was working hand in glove with the Taliban. It is. I think anyone with an ounce of sense knows that about Pakistan. As the article said, this was much before Abbottabad and Washington had then refused to acknowledge any link between Pakistan authorities, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. This is during the Bush crime family. Bush crime family targeted her for assassination. And the easiest way to do that is with an operation that could be blamed on Al-Qaeda. It killed 140 people. This is why George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of these war criminals should stand trial. This is just yet another example. WikiLeaks also revealed that several U.S. embassy cables between October and December 2007 reflect Bhutto's concerns and her attempts to impress upon U.S. authorities, particularly the ambassador at the time, Anne W. Patterson, the need to provide her physical security in the run-up to the elections. According to a cable dated October 29, 2007, Bhutto, in a meeting with U.S. Ambassador Patterson, expressed her angst over the probe by the Musharraf government into the October 18th attack. Yeah, Musharraf was going, they're going to find out, just like the 9/11 Commission report here. Yeah, Musharraf, well, we'll find out what happened. According to the cable, Bhutto claimed that authorities were involved in the attack, and they cannot be trusted with the probe. Our ambassador, the shill that worked for George Bush, disagreed. And then another cable dated October 23, 2007, also reflects the Bush administration's unwillingness to meet Bhutto's request. And, shortly thereafter, she was murdered. Huh? It's just astonishing. I'm not laughing. It's just astonishing, isn't it? Don't you think? Don't you think it's astonishing that the Bush crime family could be involved in so much murder, so much bloodshed, so many violations of international law, so many violations of the Geneva Accords or the Geneva Conventions on the conduct of between nations before, during hostilities, that the Bush crime family could commit all the criminal acts that it committed, including violations of the decisions reached at Nuremberg. And nobody in this country, nobody in positions of power, media or otherwise, political, no leading Democrats. When's the last time you heard a leading Democrat say that George W. Bush was a war criminal? By definition, not opinion, by definition of the agreements to which we are a party, A or B, agreements that we insisted be entered into the historical record. Is it time to go? Dennis Kucinich called him a war criminal. It's almost time to go. Do you suppose, gentle listener, that the Bush crime family members will ever be brought to justice? Look how long it took to bring down the mafia. I wonder. Well, let me be the first to tell you good night from the Molloy program. And take care. Keep it lit. I'll see you tomorrow night. I'm Mike Molloy.
That's a great take.